smiled proudly. "See? She's putting on weight." She handed the baby to Namora, who noticed the difference at once. The maid seemed to be gathering the courage to say something. She took a step forward. "There's something else I've noticed," she said nervously. "She's filling out nicely." "No, I don't mean that." Rosilda adjusted the blanket to reveal Dorsa's right ear. "Maybe it's just me, but the tip of her ear looks pointed." She paused, waiting for confirmation, or perhaps a word of praise. "It's only a little thing, but she'll be teased for it later," she added when Namora was silent. "We used to trim the ears of our hunting dogs at home. I don't see why it wouldn't work on a..." "No," said Namora firmly. "No one lays a hand on my daughter. She'll look fine when she's older, I'm sure." She tucked the ear under the blanket. "I don't want you speaking of this to anyone. Do you hear?" Rosild nodded, her gaze lingering briefly on Namora's red headscarf. She looked away quickly. "Very good, Rosild. Pack our trunks. We're leaving in an hour." With her daughter on her arm, she left the chamber and made herself comfortable in the great hall where a fire was roaring in an open hearth. The warmth drove out the cold of the wind and the spray, and Namora and her child enjoyed the respite. "We'll be back in the sunshine soon," she assured the sleeping Dorsa. Gastinga, the village that they were heading for, lay further inland, and Namora was looking forward to escaping from the damp. The journey to Windchime Island hadn't been easy. Following the quake, the lakes that covered 50% of Wayern's surface had overflowed, their waters combining to form great reservoirs. The flooding had claimed a handful of casualties, and the survivors had taken their misfortune in their stride, as Namora and Andakai had observed. Most had abandoned their homes and moved to one of Wayern's many islands. The majority of Wayernians lived on the lakes. Namora didn't like the thought of it. To her mind, the islands seemed dangerously impermanent, and she was sure that some of them pitched and rolled with the waves. It was said that a few of the smaller islets floated across the lakes like croutons in soup. The islanders floated with them, putting down anchor wherever the fishing was particularly good. Namora felt queasy at the notion of drifting to and fro. When the first log, a vast piece of timber bigger than the average man, had burnt to a cinder, Namora piled on more. Physically, she wasn't strong enough to shift the logs from the woodpile at the end of the hall to the hearth in the middle, so she used magic instead. As if lifted by an invisible hand, four logs rose in the air and traveled through the hall, lowering themselves dutifully onto the flames and catching fire. By now, simple spells came easily to Namora, and she performed the conjuration while singing softly to Dorsa in the tongue of her mother, beautiful, melancholy language that Fergus loved to hear. The thought of Fergus reminded her to send a prayer to Samusin and Tion, entreating them to keep him well. Rodario had sworn solemnly to do everything in his power for Fergus, and on this occasion, she believed him. He knew as well as she did that Fergus was in a critical state.
"Andakai told me to fetch you," said Rosild behind her. "She's ready to leave."
Namora stopped singing abruptly.
"What a lovely song," observed the maid. "What language was it? I couldn't make sense of the words."
"I made it up," said Namora, clasping the sleeping Dorsa and rising to her feet. "It's nonsense, really, but Dorsa seems to like it." She left the room, taking care not to meet the maid's gaze.
"You'll have to teach it to me," decided Rosild,
shouldering her bags and following her mistress outside. Fifthling Kingdom, Girdlegard, late spring, 6,235th solar cycle. Belindis ran her hand over the mail-clad arm, feeling the powerful wrist and the formidable muscle beneath her fingertips as she groped her way toward the shoulder.
She checked the alignment of the spaulders and breastplate. Fitting armor to a warrior over twice her size was quite a challenge, and wearing a blindfold made things worse. Orbits had passed while she hammered the plates into shape. Some required hinges, while others were simply laced together, although the instructions called for metal cable instead of standard leather thongs. "He won't be undressing in a hurry," thought Belindis, who was beginning to wonder whether Jeroen ever removed his armor at all. The final adjustments could be made only while the giant was wearing the suit, so Belindis had blindfolded herself securely, remembering how Teon's beasts had screamed in terror on seeing Jeroen's face. To make doubly sure, she kept her eyes closed whenever her head was turned toward him. The Maegar's measurements were incredibly precise. Most of the plates fitted perfectly, and a tap of the hammer brought the others into line. Once the fit of the armor had been verified, Belindis could set about patterning the armor as the Maegar had prescribed. Some of the runes were to be engraved, others etched with acid, and thin strips of gold and silver hammered into the grooves. Since starting work, Belindis had noticed a strange noise, similar to a growl that seemed to be coming from Jeroen, although his chest was completely still. To Belindis's surprise, his warm breath smelled fresh. She had expected him to stink like an orc, so either the smells of the smithy were masking the stench, or Jeroen was cleaner than she had thought. There was no obvious evidence of perspiration, whereas a man wearing a full suit of armor could be smelled from 100 paces or more. Belindis worked swiftly. She strapped the plates around his arms and instructed him to flex his muscles while she listened intently. The joints were perfect, no grating or creaking to indicate rubbing or stress. Relieved, she climbed down from the platform and returned to the anvil. Lifting her blindfold, she reached for Jeroen's helmet. The shiny demonic visor contrasted strikingly with the matte surrounds, and a thin strip of black tionium emphasized the ferocious eyes. Proudly, she wiped the helmet with a cloth and added a drop of oil to the hinges. "All done," she called, not knowing whether the giant could understand her. "If this isn't enough to frighten your enemies, I don't know what will." She tied the blindfold around her head and picked up the helmet, remembering to collect the skullcap made of leather-lined mail. With her free hand, she felt her way along the rope, leading back to the giant. Just then, disaster struck. Belindis stepped on something, probably a lump of coal. Her foot slid away from her. She skidded, overbalanced, and flung out her arms to break her fall. The helmet whizzed past her, one of the spikes coming within a knife's edge of her eye. It snagged on her blindfold and pulled it off. The next Belindis knew, she was sprawled on the floor, arms stretched in front of her, skullcap and helmet clutched in one hand. Raising her head, she looked up and froze. Jeroen was leaning against the anvil in front of her, and her blindfold was off. Belindis had seen some unpleasant sights in her time. She had fought in gruesome battles, duelled with hideous orcs and plug-ugly ogres, and waded in rivers of blood and spilt intestines. As a warrior, she was unshakable, but the visage before her filled her with terror. Her mouth opened in a silent scream. Massive fangs protruded from Jeroen's jaws, strong enough to bite through the toughest sinew and crush the strongest bone. The giant's skull resembled that of a human, only many times bigger, and his skin looked pale and sickly, revealing the yellow blood in his pulsing veins. He had no ears, and his nose consisted of 2 triangular holes. His enormous eyes bored into the stricken dwarf. Slowly, he straightened up, walked over, reached out an armored hand, the fingers of which could crush boulders. "He knows I've seen him. Dear Vrakas, he'll kill me." Belindis tried to run away, but her stomach was cemented to the ground. His fingers closed around her male shirt and lifted her into the air. Trembling, she let go of the skullcap and the helmet, but Jeroen caught them before they hit the floor. He strode toward the platform, deposited Belindis on top of it, and placed the skullcap and helmet in her hands. His little finger stretched toward her, sliding the blindfold over her eyes. She blinked in confusion. He spared me. The strange growling noise resumed, which she took to mean that Jeroen was ready for her to continue. In any case, it was clear that she was never to mention that she had looked on his face. Taking a deep breath, she commanded her trembling fingers to be still. A little clumsily at first, then with more assurance, she fitted the skullcap and lowered the helmet over his head, removing her blindfold as soon as the terrifying visage was hidden behind the gleaming visor. Sighing with relief, she got down from the platform and took a few paces back to admire her work. Jeroen drew himself up to his full height. Belindis felt a rush of admiration for the giant. He seemed to like his new armor, and if he didn't, he made no objection. The Maegar's illegible writing had forced her to deviate from the instructions on several occasions, but Jeroen seemed happy with the result. She had half expected her improvised formula to end in disaster, but the armor looked fine. "Vracus and Samyusin be praised." Bowing to acknowledge her skill, Jeroen picked up his weapons, returned them to their sheaths, and marched to the door, his armor gleaming darkly in the flickering light from the many hearths. Satisfied with her efforts, but relieved that the job was done, Belindis wiped the perspiration from her face and noticed that her arms felt like lead. The constant hammering had sapped her strength. "I'll drink a tankard to a job well done," she decided. She left the forge without getting changed and headed to the tavern to celebrate with a tankard of good, strong beer before bed. Congregated around the bar were some smiths and a few masons whose hair, beards, and garments were covered in powdered stone. They clinked tankards with Belindis and congratulated her on Jeroen's new armor.
"Have you heard?" asked one of them excitedly. "We've repaired the stone gateway. The doors are locked and bolted again."
"That's fabulous news," she said, joining in the general jubilation. "You must have been busy while I was in the forge."
She shook the mason's hand enthusiastically, raising clouds of dust.
"No more orcs, Bognilim, or other invaders. To think that the northern border is secure."
Her heart swelled with pride at the thought that northern Girdlegard was safe because of the dwarves.
"To the children of the smith," she cried, raising her tankard. "To the children of the smith," replied the others.
They raised their tankards, and a few moments later, one of the dwarves burst into song.
"The bad times are over,"
murmured Belindis happily, taking another long sip and wiping the foam from her lip.
"The northern pass is sealed, the dwarves stand united, and we've found some new friends."
She raised her tankard again, this time nodding at a pale dwarf who was celebrating with the group.
"How'd you like it here?"
"For the most part, very well. I wonder what Tungdal will make of our realm. I think it's harder for a freeling to adapt to the rules than the other way around."
"Oh,"
said Belindis, instantly deflated. She wondered whether Tungdil's decision to leave the kingdom had anything to do with her.
"I should really speak to him." "So Tungdil was serious about visiting the Freelings. When does he go?"
"He left 4 orbits ago, said one of the masons. "He and the twins set off for Trovegold as soon as the stone gateway was secure."
Belindis was shocked that he had left without saying goodbye.
"Is he punishing me for accepting Glaimbar?"
She had an unpleasant thought.
"Was the Freeling doctor with him?"
The mason nodded.
"Of course she was."
The others stared in surprise as she emptied her tankard
and left without a word. Windchime Island, Kingdom of Weyern, Gerdlegard, late spring, 6235th solar cycle. It didn't take long for the carriage to convey its unusual passengers to Gastinga. They broke their journey only once, and that was to make way for a battalion heading west. Under Andakai's interrogation, the commander told them proudly that he and his men were on a royal mission to investigate a possible threat to the kingdom from the outer lands. The Magar wished them luck and waved them on their way. "None of them will make it back," she predicted as the battalion marched past. A few of the men turned their heads and peered into the carriage. "They won't know the territory, and they're trained to fight on water," she said, drawing the curtains. "They'll never survive a battle on land." She knocked on the roof of the carriage to tell the coachman to drive on. As the road bore to the left, Gastinga emerged through a grey haze of rain. A collection of tiny houses, with clapboard roofs, cowered against the ground, sheltering from the swirling winds. Lush green grass surrounded the buildings, and a few boys were watching over a little herd of white cows. Neither the children nor the animals seemed to mind the rain. So much for it being warmer here. Namora checked to make sure that her daughter was properly swaddled in her bassinet. Dorsa seemed to like the movement of the carriage. At any rate, she was fast asleep. Following the guide's instructions, the coachman drew up outside a house and the guide jumped out to fetch the village mayor. The poor fellow was dragged away from his midday meal and marched through the rain to the carriage, where he waited by the window, his flat shoes sinking into the waterlogged grass. Andakai, seldom bothered with salutations and social niceties when dealing with the lower ranks. "We're looking for relatives of settlers who arrived here 70 cycles ago," she said without preamble. "Where can we find them?"
"At least have the decency to introduce yourself," said the poor man, trying belatedly to exert some authority. "What do you want with them?"
The Magar stared at him scornfully. "My name and my business needn't concern you. Suffice to say, I'm more important than a mayor. I assume from your reaction that the family is known to you. Kindly tell me where they are." She locked gazes with the man until he looked away. "Is there a reason why we can't see them?"
"No," he replied, raising his arm and pointing down the road. "It's the last house on the left."
He hunched his shoulders and hurried back inside. Namora noticed his wife and children peering at them through the window, noses pressed to the crown glass pane. They had probably never seen a carriage of any description in their lives. With a crack of the whip, the coachman drove away. The wheels of the carriage were still turning when Andakai jumped out, followed closely by Namora. The Magar hammered on the door until a man of some 50 cycles opened up. His surprise and displeasure changed to undisguised hostility as he studied the women in silence, waiting for them to speak.
"Are you going to let us in?"
demanded the Magar. It was an order, not a request.
"What for?"
he growled.
"Your carriage is twice as big as my house."
He looked them up and down, trying to guess the reason for their call.
"What do you want?"
he asked in a heavy dialect.
"We'd like to talk to you, if we may," said Namora politely. "It's raining out here and our cloaks are getting wet."
"In that case, you better talk quickly,"
snapped the man.
"Listen to me, peasant," said Andakai, her temper fraying. "We're here to protect Gerdlegard from a threat from the outer lands."
She glowered at him murderously.
"If you know what's good for your wife and children, you'll let us in without delay."
A woman's voice sounded from inside the house, and the man, swearing sullenly, stepped aside to let them pass. They found themselves in a cottage barely bigger than a hut. The walls were black with soot,
and 7 children were cramped into the tiny room. The youngest barely half a cycle old. The eldest had seen 8 cycles at most. Sitting at the table was their mother, dressed in a coarse linen tunic and a woolen jacket. She looked nervously at the strangers, whose cloaks alone were worth more than her house. Tallow candles permeated the room with a smell of burning fat. The children slept in bunks, stacked in a corner of the room, and a ladder led up to an alcove, separated from the main room by a curtain, which was all the privacy that the parents could afford. To Namora's surprise, the heap of blankets on one of the lower bunks rolled over and coughed. On closer inspection, it turned out to be a wrinkly old woman whose shriveled body was barely visible among the sheets. "Thank you for letting us in," said Namora, nodding kindly at the wife, a woman of 40 cycles or so. "Are you descended from the travellers who arrived here from the outer lands?" The woman looked questioningly at her husband, who was standing, arms folded in front of his chest, by the door. He shrugged and turned away.
"I don't understand, madam," said the woman to Namora. "We're honoured by your visit, to be sure, but..."
A worried look crossed her face.
"It's not bad news, is it? You're not going to make us leave Wayern?"
She got up, cradling the baby in her arms.
"I know we haven't made much of the land here, but the soil isn't right for farming. My husband is a good man, but the fields are like bogs."
"It's all right, woman," Andokai said sharply. "We're here to find out about your homeland, not to drive you off your land." She pulled up a stool and sat down, using her cloak as a cushion. "What are people in the outer lands afraid of? Evil spirits? Ferocious beasts? The dark power of an evil magus?"
"My homeland?"
The woman gave the baby to her husband and sat down, visibly relieved. Namora produced 4 gold coins from her purse and laid them in the woman's chapped hands.
"Here, take these," she said gently.
"Don't feel obliged to earn the money by embroidering your tale. We're interested in the truth." The woman stared at the shiny gold coins.
"So much?" she said uncertainly. "We could live on these for a cycle. Nothing I can tell you is worth that much."
Her husband strode over and pocketed the coins.
"Who are we to refuse their generosity? The money was weighing on her purse."
"Is your husband from the outer lands as well?" inquired Namora. The woman shook her head.
"He's from Wayern. Aspilla is my name. My mother was just a girl when she crossed the Red Range. Her mother left the Outer Lands because of the war."
The Maga cleared her throat.
"Let's not get distracted," she said tersely.
"Did your mother tell you legends about terrifying creatures? Maybe she told you a story about a creature so terrible that no one believes it exists." Alarmed by the Maga's harsh manner, Aspilla turned to Namora.
"The war was started by the Amsha," she said, resuming her story. "No one knows where they came from. Before anyone knew it, they were massed at the border, and the kingdom was at war. The king and his army could do nothing to stop them, so my grandmother took her daughter and fled. The Amsha killed my grandfather and his 3 brothers, and my grandmother was all alone. She and my mother settled in Wayern."
She paused and frowned.
"Could you think of another word for Amsha?"
she asked her husband.
"Amsha is what they call them over there."
"What does it matter?" said Andokai impatiently. "Since you're intent on telling me about a war that doesn't interest me in the slightest, I may as well ask her." She turned to the woman on the bunk.
Are you her mother?"
Aspilla looked confused.
"But the Amsha are a threat. They're gods, powerful gods. Before the invasion, people thought they were a myth, a scary story to make their children behave. Then they found out they were real." At last, she had the Magus' attention.
"Why didn't you say so?" snapped Andakai. "Start from the beginning. What exactly are the Amsha?"
Aspilla wrung her hands awkwardly, struggling to find the right words.
"I don't know what they're called."
She looked to the ceiling as if the answer were hanging from the rafters beside the mangy leg of ham. Namora smiled and endeavoured to compensate for the Magus' harshness.
"Samusin must be proud of me today. Why don't you tell us the rest of the story?"
she suggested.
"We might be able to work it out."
The woman nodded and began her tale.
"In the beginning, the deities created themselves, each more magnificent, splendid and courageous than the next. Before long, two of their number, Teon and Vracus, or Kophos and Esgar in the language of my mother, got into an argument about which of the deities was the best. Kophos insulted Esgar and provoked his wrath. The god of the smithy left his forge and struck the arrogant Kophos with a red-hot hammer. 10 times he hit him, and 10 times a piece of the deity fell to the ground and came to life in the form of a god. The Amsha, 10 living fragments of the Dark Lord Kophos, were born. After the 10th blow, Kophos lay stricken on the ground, and Esgar heeded his pleas for mercy. When Kophos picked himself up, he was surprised to see 10 miniature versions of himself flocking around his feet. The bold little fellows demanded to be eaten, insisting that they belonged together as one. Kophos had no intention of obliging. Laughing scornfully, he raised his boot to crush them. The Amsha took flight and swore to avenge themselves on Kophos and his creation. The 10 gods stuck together and devoted themselves to their goal, namely the destruction of Kophos's work. That was the start of the Amsha's campaign. Intent on punishing Kophos, they hunted the creatures known as orcs, wiped out trolls and ogres, and slaughtered the beasts that Kophos had created to torment our people. Their strength increased by the orbit as they harnessed the power of the beasts they destroyed. In time, they gathered a following of warriors who saw them as gods of peace. Only the Amsha's disciples were spared the fire of their wrath.
Aspilla broke off her story to fetch some water. Namora breathed out in relief.
"Orc killing, Teon hating gods, aren't much of a threat to our kingdoms. Prince Malin would welcome them with open arms." "There's more to the story, madam," said Aspilla. "The Amsha are still on a quest to wipe out evil. They were chipped from the body of a god by a red-hot hammer, and fire is their element. The heat they exude is so ferocious that the ground burns beneath their feet. Sometimes they stop for a while, and everything around them turns to ash. I've heard of lakes and rivers drying up as they pass. Everyone is afraid of them. When they invaded, the king summoned the best magicians, the purest creatures, the most honorable men, and blameless women. He thought that if he gathered a band of beings who were free from evil, he could keep the Amsha at bay. Did it work?"
Aspilla shook her head.
"I don't know, madam. My grandmother left before the Amsha reached her village."
Namora remembered the comet that had passed over Girdlegard and inquired whether Aspilla knew of a similar incident.
"Oh, yes,"
said a quavery voice. To the visitor's astonishment, the old woman sat up in bed and looked at them with lively eyes.
"Kophos was struck 11 times, not 10. The last blow was so powerful that the 11th Amsha was catapulted into the firmament and shot through the skies like a ball of fire. My mother used to say that the missing Amsha would come back to find his brothers, and the 11 deities would light up the skies with their wrath."
Andakai placed her fingertips together. The old woman's story fitted with the firstling's reports of a blazing fire in the west. She glanced at Namora, who was thinking the same.
"Thank you," she said, feigning disappointment. "You tell a good story. Not exactly what we were looking for, but you've earned the coins."
She got up and left.
"May the gods be with you," said Namora,
taking another coin from her purse and pressing it into Aspilla's hand.
"Don't neglect your farm. The money won't last forever."
She ran the few paces to the carriage and slammed the door behind her to keep out the rain. The coachman drove off before she had time to sit down. Andakai was staring through the rain-streaked glass. Namora could tell that she was worried. In spite of what she had said to Aspilla, the story of the Amsha was exactly what they were looking for. It proved that Nodon's warnings were real.
"Perhaps we were wrong to kill him," thought Namora uneasily.
She stroked her sleeping daughter's cheeks.
"The rulers of Gerdlegard would never have agreed to a truce," she reasoned. "The Magus betrayed them and caused the deaths of thousands of dwarves, elves, and men."
A terrible thought occurred to her.
"Our purest creatures have all been killed."
Bands of marauding orcs had slaughtered the last remaining unicorns in the woods of Mifidania. No other creature in Gerdlegard was as good or pure.
"Avatars!"
Andakai's plate unfurled from her hood and draped itself over her shoulder as she pressed her head against the window.
"If there's any truth in the legend, the Amshar are avatars, manifestations of the divine in earthly form, which is to say, godlike beings that can't be destroyed by ordinary weapons."
She looked at Namora.
"You know what that means, don't you? From now on, I'll have to study twice as hard," she said gravely.
Her thoughts turned to little Dorsa.
"I want you to have a proper homeland, not a barren desert of soot and ash."
"Should we tell the rulers of the other kingdoms?" she asked, keeping her eyes on her daughter's face. Andakai was struck by her Fimula's reluctance to meet her gaze, but she decided not to pry.
"It's for the best. I'll call a meeting of all the leaders of Gerdlegard when Jerun returns from the Outer Lands. The news is too important to be communicated by letter. The kings and queens of Gerdlegard will discuss the matter in Perista. Perhaps by then Queen Wei will have tidings of her warriors."
She turned to Rasild and looked at her menacingly.
"Not a word of this to anyone, or you'll never suckle another child. The people of Gerdlegard will learn of the threat from their leaders, not from an idle-tongued girl. No one will hear about the avatars until I've found a means of combating the threat."
Rosild paled and nodded hastily, swearing in the name of Palandiel not to breathe a word of what she knew.
"Good," declared Andakai. "Let's make haste to Perista. Namora, you and I have work to do."
"Of course," said the half-elf, vaguely, still gazing at her child. She was thinking about how the Maegar had unwittingly earned herself a reprieve. The avatars had to be defeated before Fergus's suffering could be avenged. She turned to the Maegar and smiled. Rodario's former leading lady was still a consummate actress.
Part 2. Chapter 1. Kingdom of Gerdlegard. Gerdlegard, late spring, 6235th solar cycle.
"Do you think you'll regret your decision?" asked Mir, looking determinedly ahead.
As she walked, she slathered her fair skin with bluish ointment from a little pot to keep off the sun. Tungdil sensed that something was bothering her. Either she didn't want him to visit the realm of the Freelings, or she was embarrassed to be seen with him, or she was worried about him leaving the Fithling folk.
Maybe she blames herself.
I won't regret it, he said after a while. He kept walking, eyes fixed on the horizon as the sun sank lower and lower, bathing Gerdlegard in fierce red light.
You don't think I left because of you, do you?
Left the kingdom, or left Belindis? Tungdil had to think for a moment.
Left Glaimbar and Belindis, he said firmly. At any rate, it wasn't because of you, which isn't to say you don't matter to me. You're different to other dwarf maidens. You're a breath of fresh air for my scholarly soul.
He turned his head and they gazed at each other for a moment. Her red eyes were full of hope.
I need time, Mir. I can't make sense of what I'm feeling because my heart and mind are so confused.
He smiled wryly.
It will do me good to get away. It's why I left the Fifthling Kingdom, to figure out what I want. Besides, I'm curious to see how the Freelings live.
She averted her gaze, focusing on a point in the distance. They had been marching toward the pond for orbits.
It's all right, she said, nodding slowly. I can wait.
Tungdil's train of thought was interrupted by a sudden noise. He turned round to see Boendal doubled up with laughter, arms braced against his thighs, howling with mirth. Tears were streaming from his eyes. Tungdil smiled.
I haven't seen anyone laugh like that since the joke about the orc who wanted directions from a dwarf. What did you say to him?
Boendil shrugged.
Nothing. I was telling him about the realm of the Freelings and he laughed in my face, he reported in a slightly wounded tone. I explained how he had to jump into a pot.
His words were drowned out by another roar of laughter as Boendal sank to his knees, shaking with mirth. For a moment, conversation was impossible.
Look what you've done to me, spluttered Boendal. I was nearly frozen to death and now you've practically killed me with your jokes.
He stood up and brushed the dirt from his breeches.
A pond, he muttered,
still hiccoughing with laughter.
As if a dwarf would dip a toe in Elria's accursed water.
Wiping the tears from his eyes, he looked up and saw their faces. At last it dawned on him that Boindil was serious.
No, he said, horrified. We're not really going to... I mean, all the way to the bottom?
He was too traumatized to say the words water or pond. Boindil clapped him on the back.
It's all right, brother. Tungdil and I jumped in last time, and it's over before you know it. If you get scared, just look at the fish.
Boendal cast a skeptical look at Mir.
It can't be the only way into your realm, he said suspiciously. How are your warriors going to get home? Don't tell me they're going to jump into the water like an army of frogs.
She grinned, showing her pearly white teeth.
There are other entrances, but Gemmel told us to keep them secret. I took Tungdil and your brother by a different route, but they were blindfolded first.
She returned the pot of ointment to her pack and led them into the woods surrounding the pond.
I'm sorry, Boendal, but you're going to have to take the plunge. It's not as bad as it sounds.
No, said Boendil crossly. It's much, much worse. I had brackish water in my ears for orbits, and Elria was laughing in my head.
At least it proves that dwarves don't necessarily drown in deep water, said Tungdil, trying to make them see the bright side. Boendal frowned, all trace of amusement vanishing from his face. His mood was grim as they marched through the forest that was formerly home to Lysintiel's elves, and he continued to scowl as they stole through the meadow on the lookout for enemies. By the time they discovered the bleached bones of their murdered comrades, his brow was creased in a permanent frown.
The party collected the scattered remains and buried them under a pile of stones. With the skeletons laid to rest, the dead dwarves would be free to warm their souls in Vrakus's smithy. It was dusk when they stepped onto the pier. Each of them held a chunk of granite as large as a dwarven head. Mir had advised them to use the debris from the elves' ruined temple to speed their journey to the bottom of the pond. They gathered at the end of the pier. "I'll go first," said Mir, beaming at Boendal, who was eyeing the water suspiciously. She stepped off the pier and disappeared into the darkness below.
"She's gone," he said anxiously. "Are you sure we should—" "Ha! You were brave enough to fight Nodon, and now you're scared of a pond?"
his brother said airily.
"Weren't you thrown into the water by a bull?"
asked Tungdil, raising an eyebrow. Boindil waved a hand dismissively.
"That was last time."
He stepped to the edge of the pier and looked down at the water with distaste.
"A cursed pond is dark and cold," he grumbled,
leaping into the air and landing in the water with an almighty splash. He disappeared.
"I suppose I've got no choice,"
sighed Boendal, resigning himself to his fate. He took a deep breath, closed his eyes and held his nose. A moment later, he was gone. It was left to Tungdil to bring up the rear. The water closed over his head, and he found himself staring into inky blackness. It was only because of the pressure in his ears that he knew he was sinking, pulled down by the weight of his armor, his axe, and the granite. He heard the sound of a waterfall, and a moment later, he was falling with the cascading water, which pushed him under the surface of the pool. The current brought him up again and deposited him on the bank. Coughing and spluttering, he clambered to his feet. The twins were there too, and he could tell from their noisy expiration that their lungs were filled with water. Mir was tightening her belt, which had loosened when she jumped.
"Next time I'm going a different way,"
spluttered Boendal, shaking himself vigorously and spraying water in all directions. He and the others were soaked through, and water was streaming from their undergarments and collecting on the floor.
"How am I going to dry my chainmail?"
he growled, running a hand over his chest.
"You'd better have some good oil."
Mir ran a hand through her bedraggled hair and laughed.
"We'll find you some warm clothes," she promised,
striding to a vast oak door with thick iron bands. She knocked loudly.
"And I'm sure I can get you some oil."
A panel opened and a pair of red eyes peered at Mir and the others. The dwarf disappeared. Then the bolt slid back and the door swung open, admitting them to the Freeling's realm. In the next chamber, Gemmel was waiting to greet them. He shook hands with them one by one, although the twins seemed a little wary.
"Did Sandra and her army get there in time?"
he asked anxiously. Mir gave a brief account of how the orcs had been defeated. "And the fifthlings have repaired the stone gateway," she recounted. "For the first time in 1,000 cycles, the northern border is secure."
"My heart weeps for our fallen comrades," the Freeling leader said gravely. "Before you go, we'll raise a tankard to our victory and remember the dead."
He pointed to a pile of blankets.
"Wrap yourselves in those. You'll catch a chill."
"Crows would be more practical," grumbled Boindil.
"You'll find clean outfits in your lodgings," the king told him,
opening a door at the back of the room. Outside, a wagon was waiting for them. Tungdil and the others clambered in, and they set off, juddering and rattling, along the underground rail. Sometime later, the wagon stopped, and everyone got out. The king led them through a magnificent hall to a double door.
"Follow me,"
he said, pressing his ring against the runes engraved in the door. The symbols pulsed with light, and the doors swung open, spilling pale light toward them.
"Enter, friends. Welcome to the realm of the feelings."
Tungdil and the twins stepped forward and found themselves on a broad ledge, from which a flight of steps led down to Gemmel's realm. Tungdil heard an awed,
"Fracas almighty!"
from Boendal behind him. They stared down in amazement. Below them was a vast city with buildings of all sizes lined up in a grid of symmetrical streets, alleyways and squares. By Tungdil's reckoning, it covered 2 square miles, and the roof of the cavern was at least 1.5 miles high. On the outskirts of the city, 2 waterfalls fell from a height of 400 paces into a reservoir that supplied a network of canals, some of which led to gardens and allotments, others disappearing into openings in the rock. From above, the city's inhabitants looked tiny, no bigger than cave ants. Tungdil, straining his ears, heard a soft murmur of voices, a sharp ring of countless hammers, and other noises that he knew from human cities. Rows of houses shaped like cubes lined the gentle slope at the far end of the cavern, at the top of which sat a small but ornately fashioned stronghold. Light came from shimmering moss that covered the walls of the cavern, bathing the city in a gentle brown glow. There were burning buckets of coal suspended from masts at various points throughout the settlement, with polished sheets of metal reflecting the light of the fiery flames.
"It's incredible," said Tungdil to Gemmel,
who was standing at his side.
"I never imagined your realm would be so big."
The king pointed down at the city.
"Trove Gold is 1 of 5. "5?
Interrupted Boindil in astonishment.
1 of 5 major cities, Gemmel continued proudly. 5,000 freelings inhabit this place, 5,000 souls living in freedom, unencumbered by the rules of family and clan, blessed by Vracus, and bound only by the will of the smith."
Boindil puffed out his cheeks, but Tungdil signalled to him to keep quiet.
"Where will we be staying?" he inquired.
Gemmel pointed to a house in the city centre.
"Those are your quarters," he said. "You'll be staying with Mir. Her house is in the thick of things, so you'll get a proper taste of city life. Sander and I live in the stronghold, but I'll call for you tomorrow and show you around."
He nodded to Mir and bade them good night. "Follow me," she said to the others, starting down the steps. "It's an honour to have you as my guests." Tungdil and the twins brought up the rear. With every step, the city increased in size, and soon the neat grid of streets became a maze of roads and buildings, although Tungdil could still detect an underlying symmetry. A fresh wind swept the smoke away from the smithies and workshops and provided the city with good, clean air. Soon they were walking through streets and alleyways. Dwarven ballads echoed from inside a couple of taverns, and on the pavements, freeling traders were hawking anvils, tools, jewellery, and other wares. A steel statue of Vracus towered 10 paces above the ground, glittering with gold and vracassium, and studded with sparkling gems. No one stopped or questioned them. Their presence went almost unnoticed, except for the occasional greeting directed at Mir.
"Have you seen their funny beards?" whispered Boindil. "I swear I saw an old dwarf with a completely naked chin. And they're wearing perfume, I can smell it."
He wrinkled his nose.
"By the hammer of Vracus, they'll soon be speaking elvish and growing pointy ears." "Where are their weapons?"
hissed Boendal.
"Most of them aren't wearing mail. It's a rum sort of place."
"Why would anyone wear mail?" asked Mir, stopping in front of her house. "Our realm is safe from orcs and other beasts. Wearing mail is completely unnecessary.
It drags you down.
Unnecessary, snorted Boindil, turning to his companions. What kind of dwarf goes without chainmail and axes? It's like walking around with no breeches or boots.
For you, maybe. But not for us. For the first time, Mir sounded put out. It was hard not to be offended by Boindil's gruff and forthright manner. In fact, his tactless comments were liable to cause as much damage as his blades. She unlocked the door and stepped inside. Come in and go straight upstairs. I don't want you ruining my carpets, she said, shooting Boindil an angry look. She disappeared into another room.
Carpets?
Muttered Boindil incredulously.
What next? Scented water for our hands?
Don't be rude, said Tungdil. We're guests here, remember? He led the way up a flight of stone steps to their quarters. As Gemmel had promised, there was a selection of dry clothes. They picked out the right sizes and peeled off their wet undergarments. As soon as Tungdil was changed, he took a closer look at their quarters and found another, narrower staircase. He went up the stairs and came to a hatch. A moment later, he was standing on Mir's roof. Amid the noise from the city, he heard scraps of conversation. Mostly it was boring, like complaints about the price of vegetables. But every now and then, someone would mention the new arrivals, or start a discussion about the other kingdoms. As far as Tungdil could tell, the majority of Freelings weren't enamored with the idea of re-establishing contact with a traditional dwarven kingdom. They were outlaws, after all. It works both ways, I suppose, he thought, somehow comforted by the realization that both sides had their doubts. He took a step forward to get a proper look. Some of the dwarves had pale hair and pale skin. Others looked no different to Tungdil and the twins. They greeted each other respectfully, exchanged pleasantries, and went their separate ways. After a while, an octagonal temple caught his eye. It was situated near the statue of Vracus, and its five tall chimneys released plumes of white smoke, infusing the air with a smell of herbs and hot metal that dispersed on the wind. Tungdil guessed that the priests were conducting a ceremony in honor of the smith. The pale smoke reminded him of the strange mist that had surrounded them in the caves of the Outer Lands, where he had discovered the mysterious rune. I wonder if the undergroundlings pray to Vracus as well. We're in time for evening prayers, said Mir, behind him. Startled, he took a step forward, coming dangerously close to the edge of the roof. Mir reached out and grabbed him. He swayed backward, knocking into her, and flung out his arms to stop her falling. For the time it takes a drop of beer to fall to the floor, they were locked together in a tight embrace. Tungdil, feeling the warmth of her body and the curve of her breasts, was glad that he had taken off his mail. He cleared his throat and stepped away. "Evening prayers?" he queried casually. Turning to look at the temple, he saw the doors fly open. Five dozen dwarves dressed in the garb of the smith filed out and took up position on the steps. Their places had clearly been allocated in advance. Everyone seemed to know exactly where to stand. The last dwarf, carrying a steel sledgehammer, came to a halt beside an anvil of pure Vracassium. It's how we praise Vracus at the end of an orbit, she explained. I told the twins to come up and watch. Boindil squeezed through the hatch. He wasn't wearing his precious chainmail, but his axes were dangling from his belt.
The best seats are taken, are they? In that case, I'll stand at the back.
He peered at the temple.
What are they doing?
He asked, staring at the priests. Mir explained the ritual.
Oh, he said. In our kingdom, we pray on our own. We give thanks together only on special occasions. It's pretty well organized,
remarked Boendal, stepping onto the roof.
What happens next?
A horn sounded its deep, rich tone, echoing through the streets and summoning the citizens of Trovegold to the statue in the square. The crowd kept swelling until the square was full of bobbing heads, some dark, others white as snow. Tungdil spotted more dwarves on top of the other buildings, which were flat-roofed, like mirrors. Everyone in the city stopped what they were doing and turned to face the statue. Mir and the others looked expectantly at the priests. The dwarf behind the anvil lifted the sledgehammer into the air, holding it above his head as if it weighed nothing at all.
Thrakus, hear our prayers of praise and adoration, he called loudly, lowering his arms to smite the anvil.
The metal rang out, producing a clear, high note, and gleaming sparks flew through the air, leaving comet-like trails and landing in braziers on either side of the steps. The staircase lit up with bright white flames. The priest in the middle of the group tilted back his head and began to sing. His voice was rich and vibrant. When the first verse was over, a second priest joined in, and so on and so forth, until half the priests were singing. What started as a solo became a stirring chorus of many singers, which swelled again as the hammer struck the anvil and the remaining priests joined in. Tungdil, who had never heard the like of it, felt a shiver run down his spine. The hymn of thanks stirred the heart of every dwarf in Trovegold, including Boendal and Boendil, who had lumps in their throats. Forgetting their reservations, they dropped to their knees and adopted the Freeling's collective method of prayer. Thrilled by the atmosphere, Tungdil watched in awed silence, wishing the singing would last forever, and knowing that it would end. The priests finished the final verse and fell silent. The hymn reverberated through the cavern, returning as a faint echo that gradually melted away. The priest struck the anvil for a third and final time. The choir filed back into the temple, and the congregation rose to their feet. The spell was broken.
So, that's that, whispered Boindil as the temple doors closed. What about morning prayers? He inquired hopefully, turning to Mir.
The firstling smiled. You'll have to lead your own prayers in the morning. The next service takes place tomorrow at dusk. She shooed him downstairs. I don't know about you, but I'm going straight to bed after dinner. You should probably get as much rest as you can. Gemmel will want to show you every last alleyway in Trovegold. He's very proud of our city. A few moments later, they were seated around a table of sand-coloured rock, ready to sample Mir's cooking. Some of the dishes were unfamiliar to Tungdil. The twins eyed the food with obvious suspicion. Mir didn't seem to mind. Boiled moss, tuber leaf salad, and sautéed cutlet in dark beer sauce, she explained. They're traditional dishes from the five dwarven folks, adapted and improved by us. She gave them each a generous helping, and they tucked in heartily, their appetite overcoming their doubts.
Said Boindil happily, holding out his plate for more. The meat tastes good. It's not goat, is it?
It's prime loin of guggle. You won't find any in Trovegold. We hunt them in the tunnels. Boindil looked at her blankly. It's a type of beetle, explained Mir. They're as long as you're tall and pretty nippy. They make a lovely roast. She pointed to the morsel of cheese on his fork. Beetle cheese. Guggle milk curdles on contact with air, so it's simply a question of salting and stretching it. She gave him another serving and handed back his plate. Boindil's fork was poised in midair. He stared dumbly at the cutlet, wondering what to do.
Lost your appetite, have you, brother? Teased
Boendal, taking another mouthful and licking his lips.
It hasn't done Mir any harm,
so it's hardly going to kill you."
He picked up his tankard and emptied it in a single draught. His burp was unusually restrained. He was on his best behaviour because of Mir. "Do you like our beer?" she inquired eagerly.
"It's delicious," he said approvingly.